Hello and welcome to yet another Cooper Talks episode. And in this one, I'm going to be doing one of the medical case studies. Although it is a case study that might have you thinking, hang on, is that history? Is that politics? Or is this turning into a science episode? I will say it's certainly not a science episode because I have absolutely no qualification or expertise in science. So any of the scientific information is scientific information I have read from others and so on. I mean, to be fair, that is how I learn all my information, by reading what other people have written and doing research and thinking about these things. That's kind of how all research goes. Anyway, that's by the way. But I'm going to be looking at the case study of the development of attitudes, changing attitudes and treatment of towards lung cancer over the 20th and into the 21st century. So this very much, for those of you who do such things, is linked to the GCSE medicine course. For those of you who don't do it, well, I hope you'll find it interesting as a bit of a case study. I suppose I should do a trigger warning for this. I'm going to be talking about lung cancer and death from that, so be warned. That's not really a very good trigger warning. Anyway, don't worry. Yes. Hopefully the title gave you a clue as well. Anyway, this is all by the side. By the way, let's get back to the key points. So I'm going to be looking at the developments in the fight against lung cancer medically, very much focused on the UK. All my statistics will relate to the UK because this is geared towards a UK academic course. But I'll also mention some of the politics that goes into it as well. And later on, I might do an episode on Eddie Bernays himself. I think he's worth an episode. If you know, you know. Eddie Bernays and the promotion of smoking, and possibly maybe about the politics of smoking bans and some of the lobbying effects around that. That would be a very future political episode. Anyway, why lung cancer? Why not one of the other cancers? Well, lung cancer is one of the big ones. It's the second most common cancer in the UK today. And unlike most other cancers, it's actually rates of survival, particularly in the UK, are quite low. Okay. And it also is a good example of one that is related to lifestyle factors. So if you've been studying the development of Western medicine, you'll know that the 20th century saw a big development in the understanding of how lifestyle factors, such as smoking or drinking or eating too much salt, fat, sugars and so on, can impact on people's health. So this was kind of new advances. And lung cancer is kind of a clear one where it's all nearly all, not always, but mostly comes down to a choice and an action. Not that you choose to get the cancer, but obviously it's through your actions and your lifestyle that you tend to contract it. Now, it mostly affects people over 40, most likely in their 70s, the people that have the highest rates of diagnosis. And most lung cancers are caused by external factors. And the big one is believed to be smoking. Okay. Now, of course, people have argued correlation versus causation here, but about 85% of all lung cancer cases involve people who smoke or who have smoked previously. So causation or correlation, there does seem to be a clear link. And actually, this has been scientifically proven. Actually, it was proven back in the 1950s. So clearly, smoking has a big impact on the chances of getting lung cancer. Now, there are other causes. It's not always smoking. Other chemicals such as radon gas, which if you've ever had to buy a home, I'm not sure why you would, but anyway. It's things like radon gas. So you have to have tests for background radon gas in the atmosphere. They can sometimes be seen as a potential cause, or any sort of carcinogenic thing that you breathe in could be linked to that. But sometimes, as with a lot of cancers, there is no apparent reason that science is able to identify, but those are very much in the minority of cases. I probably should say something. Again, I'm no medical expert. What are cancers? I mean, cancers essentially, in a very simplistic way, when your cells reproduce, something goes wrong and they mutate, and this mutation gets copied and copied and copied again. And these faulty cells start to develop as a tumour. And sometimes tumours are benign. They're just kind of a lump that's not particularly harmful. It's just there. It's a thing. It might not be very comfortable, but it's a benign tumour. But sometimes they can be aggressive and they start sort of attacking other cells, healthy cells, and spreading around the body, sort of. So they start normally from one place. So like if it starts as cancerous material in the lungs, they would be cancerous tumours in the lungs. And if untreated, they can metastasize and sort of spread around the body and affect all sorts of vital organs and so on. And obviously you're attacking key things that can make it very hard to live. And that's a very, very simplistic and basic view of the key issues with cancer. Okay. Sorry, that is very simplistic. Might have to do another episode on what exactly cancer is, but that's not really history politics type thing that I do. Anyway, there we go. Now, cancers have existed throughout history. It's just usually people died from other things before cancer had a chance to develop. And so one of the reasons why we see more and more diagnoses of cancer generally and more cases of that is because people are living longer and not dying from other things earlier. But lung cancer is kind of a different one. Because if we go back to the 19th century, so the 1800s, there really were very few cases of lung cancer discovered. And even at a time where people would have been dying earlier, I mean, age may have been a factor. But it's no coincidence that actually smoking was not that common across the population. Smoking was very much a wealthy person's habit. Lots of people had moral issues about it as well. But smoking generally was not a common pursuit. It was kind of, in the 19th century, a kind of luxury pursuit, a display of wealth. So only the very wealthy, women didn't smoke at all. And very few people outside of the upper classes could afford it. Just to give some proof, this is from Germany, because records are quite scanty on this. But the University of Dresden in Germany keeps records that show only 1% of all cancers found in autopsy during the 19th century were caused by lung cancer tumours. So lung cancer was not a very common cancer at all in the 19th century. But by 1918, according to the University of Dresden, it had increased to 10%. And then by 1927, it was more than 14%. And these rates would continue to grow. Now, why is that? Very simple reason. The tobacco companies started to market much more aggressively in the years after World War One. Now, smoking had become more common at the start of the 20th century. It became cheaper in many ways. It became open to more people. It became more of a pastime. During World War One, quite often people would smoke out of boredom on the front line as well, and it became associated with soldiers and manly issues and so on like that. But what really changed in the it started in the early 1900s, but really in the 1920s, there was a development for mass marketing using radio and colour magazines and kind of public images to associate positive images and encourage more people to take up certain habits. And the tobacco companies really use this to influence and persuade and encourage lots of people to take up smoking. So we see a big rise in the 20th century in people taking up smoking. It's seen as this luxury pastime kind of thing. And it's presented in movies and TV, and everyone thinks it's glamorous and amazing, very sophisticated. But we also see, at the same time, a rise in the number of cases of lung cancer. So those two things are going. As ever with medicine, initially people said, well, it's just a coincidence or it's correlation, but that doesn't mean causation. However, in 1950, the British Medical Research Council actually published a study that showed conclusively, scientifically, without any doubt, that the rise in lung cancer was clearly linked to cigarette smoking. And so the rise in smoking had led to the rise in lung cancer cases. However, why do you think, oh, well, that's great. We've got the scientific proof. It's been published. It's been notified from the 1950s onwards. Boom, that will stop being a problem. Everyone read that. Actually, it didn't work. Partly, the tobacco lobby, the tobacco industry, would commission its own research that kind of tried to cast doubt on this. Say, well, it's not definite, or they tried to exploit things or produce evidence that would suggest there is no proven link between smoking and lung cancer. And a bit like climate change today, you've got, you know, lots of evidence that proves it is happening, but people try and produce evidence that suggests no, it's not happening, it's not man-made. Well, it was similar with tobacco smoking. So even in Britain by the 1970s, the deaths from lung cancer reached a peak of about 26,000 deaths due directly to lung cancer. That was the peak for men, and for women, the rates of lung cancer would continue to grow until the 1990s. So it was a big problem. And the question might be, why? Why did it take, about 40 to 50 years for the government to take big action? And why didn't the technology help with this? So let's start with the use of technology to diagnose. Well, first of all, one of the reasons why lung cancer is so deadly is because it has and is very difficult to detect. And by the time you detect it, it's usually quite advanced. And kind of the treatments are almost as bad as the cures. Now, partly the symptoms can be mistaken for other diseases that might be relatively minor. And there's currently at the moment, this is 2023, there's sort of an NHS campaign that's saying, oh, if you've got a cough, it might be nothing, but it might be something. So go and get it checked out to try and get people to get tested earlier, because a lot of people say, oh, I've just got a bit of a cough. And probably they do, but it can be a sign of lung cancer. And people aren't routinely tested. It's not like, say, breast cancer, where women will routinely go for mammograms to detect any changes or anomalies. We don't have regular screening for lung cancer. And that's because the technology is not accurate enough to outweigh any of the negative effects. So traditionally, well, I mean, the way to do it is exposing the body to radiation through x-rays. And that used to be how they'd diagnose, by taking an x-ray and seeing if there was a mass in the lung. Trouble is, that is exposing you as well to radiation, and you don't want too much of that. And also at the same time, particularly before developments in radiography and so on, all you could see was a dark mass, which may or may not be cancer on the lung. It was very hard to be definite about what was there. So using x-ray machines was a bit hit and miss, and people didn't have the certainty. A doctor was kind of looking at it saying, yeah, that mass looks like it's probably a cancer. Because people get other sorts of tumours, they get abscesses in the lungs, which is certainly not fatal. Or, more often, cancer might be there, but people say, oh, it's just something else that you don't need to worry about. So because they weren't accurate, they couldn't be relied on for effective testing, which, again, by the time they came up with accurate diagnosis, it was probably too late. So x-rays were the main way, but in kind of the 21st century, the modern era, you're much more likely to be given a CT or a CAT scan that creates a much more detailed picture of the soft tissue inside the body. So it's much better than x-ray. So there's a technological example. To help with this, patients will usually be injected with a dye, which helps the lungs show up more clearly on the scan, because the dye will go through the blood and it kind of highlight things, and it makes it easier for doctors to identify anomalies that shouldn't be there. If the CT scan shows cancer might be present in the lung, then the doctor's got one of two choices. If it doesn't look very advanced, they'll give the patient a PET CT scan, which is kind of like a CT scan, but it's a bit smaller. It's a bigger procedure, but there's a small amount of radioactive material is injected instead of the dye. And this will help identify cancerous cells, because it kind of will come out more clearly on the radiography, and it'll be able to highlight the differences in cell density and so on, I believe. The other option, if it's a bit more advanced, is they'll give them a bronchoscopy, Sorry, this is a bit like an endoscope where you've got a little camera on a sort of tube, and basically pass it into the patient's lung and collect samples of the cells for testing. So not quite a biopsy where they cut the material out, but they will collect cells for testing. And after carrying out these two tests, the doctors will be able to determine what type of cancer the patient has and how far advanced it is. And that makes it easier to draw up a potential treatment plan to deal with the cancer. So that's how lung cancer gets diagnosed today. If it's diagnosed early enough, then there is the possibility of an operation to remove the tumour and the infected portion of the lung. Depending on how big the tumour is and how serious, you could have the entire lung removed. Okay, you can live with just one lung. Obviously, it affects your quality of life, but you can live and survive. So that is one option. But there are problems with this, because usually, there are other health concerns related to smoking, which can include heart issues, high blood pressure, and things like that. And that can make the surgery potentially quite dangerous. The other issue is, and this is going to be something with transplants that we can talk about, there is a kind of moral debate about treatments, okay? And because in the UK we have a national healthcare system, so that means medical treatment is free at the point of use. For my listeners from around the world, yes, it's not that the healthcare is free, it's that everyone pays for it through taxation, and that's based on how much you earn and your relative income. But when you need medical treatment, whatever it is will be provided for you free at the cost of you. So you don't have to worry about the cost of prescriptions or the cost of an actual treatment or so on. But of course, because everyone's paying into that, if it's something like lung cancer, which most likely you have contracted yourself or caused yourself through smoking, what's the NHS's responsibility there? Okay, now this is a very heated debate there, because you could then say, well, hang on, if someone's chosen to go skydiving and they've broken their leg, that's their choice. If someone's had a little bit too much fun at the weekend and had a few too many alcoholic beverages, but they've had a bit too much to drink and then, either get alcohol poisoning or do something rather stupid, again, that's their fault. So there's a kind of whole sort of moral debate there about this, which we'll look at with the sort of British government taking action on this. But where that moral sort of debate really comes in is with transplants, because thanks to the technological advances in medical treatment across the 20th century, we now have the technological ability to do lung transplants. So like with any organ, you find a match, someone who has died but has a healthy set of lungs, that you could basically swap in to a person who's suffering from lung cancer. Now, that's obviously a complicated procedure. We don't need to go into that. But the debate there is, if there's a healthy pair of lungs, should a person who was a long-time smoker and therefore probably got lung cancer that way, should they get it ahead of someone who isn't a long-term smoker but maybe has another lung condition? And is it, there's a whole debate and moral set of issues around that, which is something to think about. I'm not going to give an answer, because it's not for me to answer these. You need to work out your own opinions. So transplants are another possible cause. Radiotherapy is another one. That's where you use sort of concentrated waves of radiation, from the electromagnetic spectrum. And they're aimed at the tumour, and they're designed to shrink it. Okay, so it's very targeted. And if you've got small tumours, they can be treated this way instead of surgery. Try and shrink them down. Maybe they disappear completely. Okay, which would be really nice. Larger tumours might be using radiotherapy. This might stop them from getting any bigger as well. The way it sort of works, again, not a scientist here, but they sort of target the beams of the radiation at the tumour from outside the body. Or they can place a small piece of radioactive material next to the tumour using a very thin tube called a catheter. Lovely. So they try and do that to target it at the tumour itself, to either shrink it or to stop it growing. So that's radiotherapy. The other one that people often assume with this is chemotherapy. And that's when patients are actually injected with a variety of drugs, quite often radioactive themselves, and using various chemicals and so on. And these are there to shrink the tumour, ideally shrink it down to a small size before surgery. But it can also be used to prevent a cancer from recurring, kind of to make sure all the cells have been eliminated, or maybe even kind of as a palliative care to try and provide some relief from the symptoms of lung cancer when surgery is not possible. Radiotherapy, like chemotherapy, does come with some major side effects, okay, and they, you know, it can influence the person's immune system anyway. And effectively, you know, the chemotherapy is like another type of poison. And what you're hoping is that particular poison will destroy all the bad cells before it does too much damage to the good cells in the body. So the treatment is tough, tough for any form of cancer, including lung cancer. Now, lung cancer patients in the 21st century in the UK are most likely to be treated using a range of these strategies. So they might have surgery to remove a tumour and then radiotherapy and chemotherapy to tackle any remaining cancerous cells. And remember, we are talking at the cellular level. And while surgery is very advanced now, it hasn't quite got down to removing specific cells. You might be thinking, oh, what about genetic research? Well, genetic research has gone so far in diagnosis, in kind of maybe setting out who's more likely to contract lung cancer or who might respond in a particular way to lung cancer. But as things stand, genetics can't be used to treat lung cancer. But, you know, doctors have been analysing it and they reckon some forms of radiotherapy or chemotherapy drugs work better for some patients if they have a particular genetic combination. They can't explain why, but they're developing this practice. And that would kind of have the advantage of making it more tailored and specific and potentially more effective on an individual basis rather than a kind of treating everything all the same. So it's a more bespoke way of doing it. But that's quite in its infancy. Now this idea of tailoring treatments to a specific DNA is a new field, and it's a growing field in the 21st century, and it's called, I'm going to mangle this, pharmacogenomics. I'm not sure if it's a hard C or a soft C. So that, as well as something called immunotherapy, a kind of developing treatment. So immunotherapy is another potential treatment where cancers that are able to resist the body's immune system to block their growth. So people have been trying to boost the body's own immune system to try and stop cancer cells from resisting it. So it's kind of like a kind of arms race, using the immune system and boosting it so the immune system's more effective at fighting cancer. These are developing tracts. As you may have got from this, the nature of treatment is tough. So currently, the British government's policy is it's far better to prevent it than to cure it. And this puts it in line with most history of Western medicine. Now, this goes back to that point of the link being discovered between smoking and lung cancer in 1950. And why did it take so long for the government to do anything? By 1985, we've got evidence smoking-related deaths were costing the NHS around £165 million a year. No-brainer. Get rid of smoking, save the NHS £165 million a year. Except at the time, the government was earning about £4 billion a year from duties and taxation on tobacco. So financially, it was doing better from the sale of tobacco than the NHS was losing out. However, and also beyond that, lots and lots of people in the UK up till the 1980s were employed in the tobacco industry, either in high level positions or relatively low ones. And there is, and this comes down to a moral issue that we might have seen throughout history, which is it the government's job to tell people how to live their life? And that's an interesting one. And by past that, we were used to a society where there's rights and freedoms. We have lots of rights from the government. The government cannot tell us what to do. It cannot make us do things. But obviously with smoking, the government from the 1990s onwards starts to take more active action. Actually, it does it a bit earlier than that, to be fair. But they start taking action to try and stop people from smoking, to restrict their freedoms, even in private spaces, not rather than public ones. And there's obviously a health benefit for that. But then people start accusing the government of being a nanny state and being controlling and saying, well, you don't have the right to control us in that way. You know, I have the freedom to make this decision myself. And that is a big debate. OK, what takes priority here? Public health and the cost to the NHS or individual freedoms? And do people have individual freedoms to do something that is damaging to them? And this is a whole debate. We obviously aren't going to deal with it or solve it here. You will have your own opinions on that. So, financially, the government is doing well. But as the number of deaths began to rise, it kind of became clear that just morally, the British government had to intervene to protect its population, a bit like the Public Health Acts in the Victorian era. Thanks to John Snow's research, said, oh, like there's so many people are dying of cholera, we need to do something to kind of stop this before it gets too bad. Now, the way to think about this is the government has two kind of methods. There's the traditional carrot and stick approach. So a very cruel analogy, but, you know, it used to be, how do you get a donkey to move? Well, you can either hit it on the backside with a stick to make it go forward. That's kind of punishing it or incentivizing it. No, not incentivizing, just punishing it, trying to force it. And the carrot is to give it an incentive, so it'll move forward because it wants to eat the carrot that's in front of it. So the stick approach, trying to force a changing behaviour, is using laws and fines and making bans on things in order to force the public to change their attitude and their behaviour. So in terms of smoking, the government took the following action. In 2007, the government banned smoking in all workplaces. And this would include social places like pubs, cafes, restaurants, or offices. So it used to be very common that people would smoke in these areas. And for those of us of a certain age, we remember going to pubs and cafes and restaurants, and you'd come out stinking of tobacco smoke. And there's lots of fears that this would lead to the collapse of pubs and people would stop going to restaurants and so on. But the government introduced bans, said no. And the reason, partly for yourself, but it was also to protect the workers in these places, you know, the bar staff, the waiters and waitresses and the cooks and just other people in the office who were having to breathe in all this tobacco smoke. So it was there to help protect people from secondhand smoking. In 2007, the government also raised the legal age for buying tobacco from 16 to 18. And again, that was because of a rise or concern about the number of teenagers who were smoking and just trying to make it more difficult for those under 18 to take up smoking. In 2015, they actually extend the ban to smoking workplaces to cars carrying children under the age of 18. So it's not an outright ban on people smoking in cars, but what it's saying is if you have anyone under 18 in the car or whatever it might be, you are not allowed to smoke in it. And again, that goes back to that privacy one, because some people argued, hang on, this is my car, my children, I have the right to decide what I do. If I want to smoke in my private car, I am allowed to do that. I'm not doing anything illegal. Well, I mean, they are obviously by the law now, but they're not doing something that is illegal in itself. Smoking, it is legal in the UK, and it's in private property in their private sphere. Why can't they do that? The argument being, though, that the government has a responsibility to protect children from secondhand smoke, and that kind of trumps the individual liberty to make your own choices. Again, there are lots of issues and debates about that. The fourth and final sort of stick approach, and the government regularly uses this, is to increase taxation duties on tobacco products. And the government has been doing this. Now, I have no idea what cigarettes actually cost now in a pack, but kind of the prices have gone up a lot, okay? And that's made it almost prohibitively expensive that some people, just from a financial point of view, can't afford to smoke because if it's costing, I don't know, £10, I think it's £10 now, somewhere around, it's costing £10 a pack, and you were smoking a pack a day, that's £70 a week. Okay, and you can do the maths for how much that would be in a year. That is a lot of money. And even if it doesn't stop someone from smoking outright, it might reduce the amount they're smoking. It will also be used to cover the costs of treating lung cancer and smoking related issues there. So that's the cost, that's the kind of stick approach. The carrot approach, the influencing, I'm not sure it's really incentivizing like a carrot, but trying to influence public behaviour and make people want to be more healthy, okay, and change their lifestyles. Well, one of these was a ban on tobacco advertising, okay, to kind of stop it appearing so often. And there was an outright ban on tobacco advertising on television back in 1965. And then in 2005, it banned cigarette advertising entirely. And there were, I mean, you might find this crazy now, but back in the sort of 70s, 80s, 90s, football teams and sporting events would routinely be sponsored by tobacco companies to get around various bans and restrictions, or to make it seem more glamorous and so on. So, but now it's even sporting events, sponsorship, it's all gone. So tobacco and the association with tobacco has been removed. There's no way of promoting it legally. The government's also produced lots of campaigns to try and raise awareness of it. They've changed the packets of cigarettes to show pictures of all the sort of horrible and awful things you can get to try and make people go, oh, that's disgusting. I don't want to get that. I'll stop smoking. Big one targeted at pregnant women from smoking. Listing the number of chemicals, producing scientific research to show about the health impacts. Education in school, part of the PSHE curriculum, was brought in to discourage young people from smoking, has been brought in. So again, trying to educate them, and actually not directly by the government. You've also noticed there's been a shift. If you look at TV and movie shows, TV shows and movies, kind of in the 40s, 50s, 60s, the hero would smoke and the villain would usually not smoke. And that was like, oh, that's suspicious. Whereas now, if you look, the bad guys smoke, good guys do not smoke in movies. And actually, it's become much less common to see anyone actually smoking in TVs and movies. And if they do, it's usually portrayed as a villain or someone who's going through something terrible at the time. And again, this is all part of that perception and trying to change attitudes towards smoking. And lastly, government research was commissioned, and in 2012 said that actually, in order to discourage young people from smoking, you just need to remove the temptation. And so that led eventually to all cigarette products having to be removed from display. So they're all sort of hidden behind cabinets. They can't be there so that people see all the shiny, fancy packaging and go, ooh, that looks nice, can I try that? So these have been to try and change behaviour. And that, along with the ban in workplaces, means it's much less common to see people smoking. It's not as prestigious. It hasn't got the kind of high profile that it used to have. So these combinations of government actions have reduced quite dramatically, actually, the number of people who actually smoke in the UK. It's not eliminated it by any means, but it has dramatically reduced. And it's led to a huge change in attitudes among the public. I think now a lot of people, if they went into a pub or restaurant and someone was smoking, they'd be horrified by that and complain. So the number of smokers is falling. And we see this throughout publications. And even, I mean, it's worth bearing in mind, when David Cameron was Prime Minister, he'd given up smoke and then he sort of took it out, but he hid it because he knew it would look really bad as the Prime Minister. And there is this thing that it's very bad now to be associated with tobacco smoking in any way. And if you do, you'll be betrayed in a very negative connotation. All of this to stop people from smoking and to try and reduce the amount of lung cancer treatment. In many ways, this is all very similar to the John Snow case study. In both cases, there was a slow response initially. It took time to respond to the evidence. But when they did, the government eventually does take direct action. So the 1875 Public Health Act to force cities to clean up, compared to the government banning smoking in the workplace in 2007. So slow initially, but gets it in the end. What a useful way of comparing case studies across two time periods. Okay, that is basically kind of the case study information you need if you're studying GCSE on lung cancer development and how it fits in to medicine. And there's a little bit of the politics and the sort of moral issues around it as well, which I threw in just to enrich your experience. What egotistical nonsense that sounds from me. But anyway, I hope you've found this useful. There's some interesting data there. I'm going to be doing the case study on Fleming and penicillin. It's a bit more historical next time. But thank you for listening and good luck with your studies or your general interest. Bye for now.